Index investing or passive investing has grown more popular with investors. Even Warren Buffett touts the benefits of owning an entire index like the S&P 500 over the long term. An example of an index tracking ETF is BMO's S&P 500 Index ETF. It's the largest ETF in Canada that tracks this well-recognized and popular index. It provides exposure to the returns of the market cap-weighted S&P 500 index at a low cost, the management fee of just 0.08%. This broad market ETF makes for an efficient building block in a portfolio, saving you time and effort while mitigating single stock risk. If you're looking for exposure to the largest and most liquid public companies in the United States, this ETF delivers an easy-to-use solution and instant diversification. Commissions and management fees and expenses all may be associated with investments in exchange-traded funds. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to Looney Hour, episode 127. As always, joined by the three amigos. We've got Keith Dicker of Ice Cap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM. What's going on, gentlemen? Keith, you're back.
I'm back from some vacation and stuff like that. Feels good. Yeah.
You look pretty tan, hungover.
Well, I'm tanned. I'm not hungover at all. That's not me. But yeah, it was real nice. You know, you get away, hang out with the family a bit, enjoy some of the nice weather, and what a great culture, a lot of beautiful people down there. It was really good. Highly recommend it and suggest it.
How about you, Rich?
Yeah, I didn't have that. What was I enjoying? Yeah, one called the Miami Vice and the Riviera Mayan or something. So I'd go up to the bar and I'd say, hey, I want a fruity rum drink with lots of colors in it. And the guy looks at me, you know, I said, yeah, like make it as crazy as you want, you know, this obnoxious thing. And so they love that. Then they're not working off the menu.
How many times did you pee in the pool? Be honest.
Usually every time you're in the pool, you know, you might get some leakage.
It's terrible. We do not endorse that here at the Looney Hour. Use the facilities. How was the food, Keith?
Yeah, food is beautiful. Yeah, we were at a nice place.
So was it too spicy for you? For your
no,
Caledonian
no.
self?
You know, I was raised in Newfoundland where the main herbs were salt and pepper and vinegar.
You got to be careful down in Mexico.
Yeah, I know. So over the years, I managed to, you know, widen my palate. So it was quite good. But speaking of wide palates and fruity drinks and all that, Rich, what do you got going on?
Honestly, it's been a very slow week. I'm just biding my time for the up north adventures, where I get to use my chainsaw and muck about in the woods and go canoeing. And yeah, it's just a magic day in Montreal. It's beautiful. It's almost that day of the year where it seems like all the women across Montreal either get the memo or they all decide together that they're supposed to they let us all know that it's spring. And it's, I remember this because I went to McGill in Montreal and there was always that one day, and somehow they all coordinate. I don't know how they do it, but we're almost there, I feel like. So that's it.
You had any good dates lately?
No, it's the well has ran dry, sadly.
So let's get this straight then. Your response to the nice weather in Montreal, which is, you know, seems like to be triggering a change in seasonal wear.
Yeah.
Your response is to go to the woods by yourself with a chainsaw?
That sounds pretty good, not gonna lie.
I'm a bit of a contrarian, Keith, and now that you highlight the flaw in my logic, perhaps I'll reconsider. But anyways, until next week. Anyway, Steve, set us up. What are we going to talk about today?
We had US CPI this week, so we'll kind of dive into that. We got the crypto bull market raging on. We got some updates from OSFI, I think, who's been tuning into our podcast. And yeah, I mean, you know, we have the carbon tax stuff, which we've been talking about quite a bit. So if anyone that hasn't maybe been paying attention to that, there's been this ongoing feud around, Keith, you know, Atlantic Canada's exemption on the carbon tax for home heating fuel, basically. And of course, you know, Saskatchewan came out and was like, well, hold on a minute, it's pretty cold here. You know, we use a lot of natural gas and you guys aren't exempting us. So we are no longer going to collect the carbon tax in Saskatchewan. And so they held to that and they've basically not been collecting the carbon tax. And now all these, you know, of course, there's supposed to be an increase to the carbon tax starting in April. We've got this cost of living crisis. Inflation's still sticky. Interest rates are still high. People are clearly struggling. I think the messaging around the carbon tax has been horrible to begin with. They just, what did they just change the name to? Like the carbon rebate plan or something? I don't even know what it's called at this point.
Straight out of Soviet Russia. Sorry, I couldn't help
Anyways,
myself.
Anyways, they rebranded and remarketed it, but basically they've now got all the premiers, not all of the premiers, but a huge chunk of the premiers, including some of the Liberal premiers across Canada, are now saying that they need to pause the April increase. So we have, so far, New Brunswick, PEI, and Saskatchewan says it will no longer remit the money it owes for the carbon price on natural gas as required by law. And you have Alberta, Ontario, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and Labrador have weighed in, calling for Trudeau to pause or cancel the coming increase in April. So you've pretty much got all of these premiers across Canada, I mean, the vast majority of them, saying no more increases. And so now, from a political perspective, of course, this is just a hot potato. He's still trying to run it through. I think, you know, he was out in a couple interviews this week saying that, you know, his job is not to be the most popular person. It's to do the right thing, which I was kind of scratching my head because I was like, well, aren't you like, isn't your job to be popular because you're voted by the people to serve the people? So if it's unpopular to have this policy,
I don't know. I kind of let that one slide. He's done a lot of stupid things and he will continue to do stupid things. That was like one comment where I felt it didn't really, what he meant was he's supposed to lead. But the problem is that everyone thinks this is a stupid idea. Anyways, not everybody, excuse me. A lot of people do. And clearly the provinces do. Keith, do you know if they can actually do this? Can they just not? I mean, has this ever happened before?
It's funny. When I was a kid, I knew. So one of the great-grandfathers of one of the families, you know, we hang out with, his name was Johnny Chater. So we called him Uncle Johnny Chater. He's probably 190 years old, Steve, this old fella in rural Newfoundland. Whenever something exciting would happen, he would sit there in his rocking chair going back and forth. He'd say, boy, oh boy, oh boy. You know, you knew something cool was going on, right? And I think right now for Ottawa and the prime minister, you know, Uncle Johnny Chater, he's passed, otherwise he'd be 240 years old now, but he's definitely saying boy oh boy oh boy. So let's walk through this. Okay, let's just say that he does put a pause where he cancels the tax on April 1. So that's political suicide, correct? For his, you know, yeah. He's going to pause it. People will like that, of course, but his base, they're going to lose it. They're saying, hey, you know, especially Steve's friend Gibo. Correct.
Oh man, that guy's the worst.
Friend of the show.
Yeah. Friend of the show. Of course, he's friendly with us. And you know, of course, you know, then the prime minister's overlords, who are not really, you know, have my own theory on where they're from, and I don't really think a lot of them are here in the country. But you know, they're not going to be very happy with this. But let's just say then that he does keep it on, that he doesn't do the pause or the cancellation of it. Then all of a sudden he has, you know, even people within his own party are going against him. So, you know what, it's really one of these unfortunate corners, you know, that they've been backed into. But let's be fair, you know, he's kind of rich when he does housework. You know, he swept himself into the corner. Yeah. How do you get out of it? How do you get out of this? I don't know. But I think it's very clear that, you know, it's not, you know, there's no easy way out. But I think a lot of people, you know, open-minded, they would say, you know, it really wasn't going to add any value anyway. So I'm sure, you know, Rich, yeah. You might have an idea too, Rich, that all the taxes being collected in Canada, how that's going to reduce, you know, pollution in China. I don't know.
It won't.
Yeah.
I think the overall arching, I know we've got like, let's, you know, we get feedback emails from our listeners here, which we always encourage and appreciate. And, you know, we know that people have different views on, you know, the environment and carbon taxes, and some people think it's a good idea. That's totally fine. We're not here to sort of debate and discuss that. Merely, you know, this just highlighting, I think, the overarching theme, which is Canadians are hearing, again, I know there's a rebate and everything, but Canadians just hear taxes, cost of living. I think people are clearly falling behind, and so this is just, it's just not a popular tax. And I think the way that it's been marketed, you know, anytime you go and exempt one province, it was basically doomed to fail. That was the end, I think, of that policy.
So that's why I'm going to jump in there. So I think that's just like, I know we've gone on and on about this, but I think some context, and for people who are new listeners to the Looney Hour, I think it's important that the first time we ever discussed this, the carve out, we shared with people the differences between the share of residential heating energy in the West, which is mostly, and the West I consider Ontario, just for the sake of this argument, is mostly natural gas. So Ontario, 66%, Manitoba, 55%, Saskatchewan, 80, Alberta, 80, BC, 47. And then in the East, oil, so basically oil share, like literally like black sludge that they pour from a tank, the oil residential share of energy heating is PEI is 49, Nova Scotia 36, Newfoundland 22, and New Brunswick, I don't know what they're doing, but 7. Oh yeah, lots of coal in those places as well. And so basically the carve out was for heating oil. And so, and the reason he did that was because he was getting killed in the polls. And normally the East Coast is a staunchly liberal stronghold. And so this was a shameless political carve out, A. B, coal is worse on CO2 emissions than natural gas. And C, the carbon tax, I'm sorry, I know some very close to my friends of mine will disagree with this, but it does not make any difference to global emissions in any way, shape, or form. But the first two points are really the key ones, which is the share of residential heating, where it's just a horrible, shameless political carve out. And I think he deserves everything coming to him.
Yeah. Hey, go ahead, Keith.
Yeah. I don't know the number, but is there an estimate on what the actual dollar value of taxes raised by the heating oil or the new carbon tax? Have you guys seen that before?
I don't have
this actually one. Carries over into another conversation that we'll have as well.
Yeah, well, I wanted to kind of keep following along on that, just kind of tying in with the carbon tax. There was a good article this week that was put out by a guy named Adam Leggy. He is with the president of the Business Council of Alberta, kind of talking about the emissions cap that's been put forward by the federal government. So it's basically highlighting that, you know, well, it is great to obviously reduce emissions in the oil and gas sector, right? I mean, that's, I think a lot of people would get on board for that. Is that, you know, what is that going, what are the impacts of that? So it may force the oil and gas sector, of course, to cut production to comply and avoid jail time. Yes, potential jail time. So fewer fossil fuels will be produced in Canada. But when you look at it, Rich, the oil and gas sector is by far Canada's largest economic sector, larger than the automotive and banking sectors combined. You know, it accounts for 30% of Canadian exports. And so they recently modeled it. The Conference Board of Canada modeled the impact of the production cuts because of the cap. And so it found that it would lead to a one-time but permanent drop in Canadian economic activity of 22 to 40 billion, and so that's the equivalent of the provincial budgets of Saskatchewan and Nova Scotia combined, and also suggested that between 80,000 and 150,000 jobs will be lost across those sectors in the country. So, you know, because I think that kind of ties into Canadian productivity. There's been some circulation this week on, you know, Canadian academics talking about, yeah, everyone's trying to figure out what's wrong with Canadian productivity, right? It's just continues to sort of roll lower. And there's been some good arguments this week saying, well, it kind of seems to largely coincide with how well the oil and gas sector is doing from a commodities perspective, Rich.
Partly true, but Keith, I think, wanted to jump in there. No, he did not. Okay, well, I did.
Okay, I did. I'm older. It took me a while to get the mouse moving across the screen. It's not an important comment, but it is a loony hour comment. You know, we went a couple of weeks without mentioning Saskatchewan. Now, I think now we've mentioned Saskatchewan probably seven times in the first 20 minutes today. So we're back on, you know, that theme again. That's it. That was the only comment, Rich.
Thank you for that very useful contribution.
Yeah. By the way, everyone, Steve, like, this is where Steve is rolling his eyes, of course. He's like, my God, will you give it up? But over to you, Rich. What do you got there?
Well, I just want, just quickly on the oil thing. I mean, I'm not sure if oil and gas is bigger than banking, but I think it's what it does do is it contributes a massive, massive, massive amount of hard currency. Remember, Canada, without Canada's oil sector, Canada would be running a massive budget deficit, which would put pressure on our currency, which would be inflationary. So right now, Canada, as a percentage of GDP, our current account balance is in balance, so roughly zero. And goods ex energy is 4.7% of GDP. And why that's important, because that's an enormous number. I know four doesn't sound like a big number, but it is. And then you have the energy products are 4.5%. So, and that hard currency inflow, which is basically all US dollars, is supportive of our currency. And if we, and because we have a lot of debt and because we're not productive, if we just ran massive current account deficits, that would be bad or put downward pressure on our currency. And that downward pressure on currency would do one of two things. One, you'd have to fight that, which is to raise interest rates, keeping real interest rates high to attract foreign investors. Or two, you would just suffer massive inflation and maybe who knows what would happen to foreign investor demand or whatever. So the fact that we do export as much oil as we do, about 4.5 million barrels a day, which is the fourth largest in the world, is what effectively supports our standard of living, decreasing as it may be, and supports our welfare state, right? Alberta royalties are distributed across the nation and pay for an incredible amount of this country. And so just when you're thinking about that, either going to have something to replace them, replace that inflow of cash, or yeah. And anyways, that's I just think people need to remember that when they're thinking about these problems.
Well, speaking about our wealth, for all these academics, Rich, there's still people out there on Twitter talking about Canada's real GDP per capita and how it's been falling and not even remotely kept up with our counterparts in the US, still arguing that this is not a good way to measure living standards in Canada. And I would just encourage you guys that are out there doing that, just to put the spreadsheet down, take a walk and get out of the house, because it's, I mean, Rich, I'll let you take the floor on this one.
Well, I mean, GDP per capita, as everybody has heard me say, is just another proxy for productivity. Now, there are always problems with using such a blunt instrument in describing the economic transactions of hundreds of millions of people, or 40 million people in this case. But the reality is that for 25 years, it was basically moving in lockstep with the United States. And then at some point, it dislocated. And you could talk about median incomes, which, by the way, the data is not updated, so that's a shitty number to use. But you can try your best to square all these different circles, but that's a real number. Population growth, we more or less understand. And GDP, despite its flaws, we more or less understand. And if that number is going down, that's bad. And you know, all this navel gazing around the whether or not it's the appropriate figure or not, to me, is, you know, you're just carrying water for basically shitty economic policy. And I think people can feel it. I don't know, Keith, maybe that's not strong enough. I'd love to hear your view, because you've been around for a long, long time. You must have seen some of these declines in the past.
Yeah, not as long as Uncle Johnny Chater, remember? Boy, oh boy.
250.
I know. I think at the 350 mark by now, as the show goes on. I think it's something that's important for people to recognize. When, you know, when we comment that productivity is declining, a lot of people take it personally and they think it means you're not working as hard as you should be, right? That's the, especially if you have, you know, if you know people on the government sector, they think, hey, I'm working just as hard now as I used to. In fact, I'm actually working even harder now, right? Because they're people working from home, you know, their productivity goes up and stuff like that. But I think though people should understand that when we're saying productivity is decreasing, one of the key contributions of that is the amount of debt that's being used to generate that exact same $1 of economic growth. So if it's taking increasingly more and more debt to produce that same dollar of growth and more people coming in to produce that same dollar of growth, again, we become less productive as a country. So again, I just want to sort of set that stage for everyone, which then is going to eventually come back to, you know, the conversation that I want to have, of course. But we have to look at how is this going to change, right? How do we sort of prevent this from declining or deteriorating further? How do we self-arrest it? You know, if you're in the mountain climbing world or something like that. But it is a very serious issue. And one great thing now that's happening, you know, I think, Steve, you're seeing it quite a bit, same with you, Rich, is, you know, the conversation is happening more. You know, people, you know, they're debating it, you know, whether, you know, per capita data points are important or not. It seems like, you know, everyone has their agenda, if they want to support that view or not.
They were, it was always important until about 5 minutes ago when it didn't, when everyone realized it was flat for 8 years. And then people say, oh, yeah. Like when you look at the IMF, which is a very good source of data, when they compare countries' wealth, or, you know, they compare whether a country is violent or not, or whether they have good healthcare outcomes or not. When you look at a country to see if they're buying enough EVs or if they're lowering their emissions, or it's always done per capita. And yes, we understand that GDP is a blunt and flawed way of viewing the productive capacity of a country. But that's what we got. And all this bullshit about how we don't care about per capita GDP is literally 5 minutes old. That those people should be ignored. And sorry, Keith, but that's just like...
Well, yeah, I mean, to that point, Rich, like, I mean, the simple way I would just do it, like, again, I know, like, everyone wants to sit in their spreadsheet and try to, like, you know, twist the numbers to fit, like, a certain narrative. But, I mean, I still look at it and say, like, what's most people's largest expense, which is I think it's housing, and so I think we can all collectively say that the housing market in Canada is pretty broken. It's almost near impossible for the younger generation to actually get into housing without some pre-existing wealth that's already in the marketplace. And so I'd say, you know, to me, that's a standard of living crisis that, you know, is declining, where people can't enter the housing market. We had some new data out this week from rentals.ca, which, of course, is probably one of the leading indicators, data collectors on rents. So asking rents in Canada, they are up again in February. They've now grown 21% over the past 2 years. And are still climbing higher. They got to actually pushed higher to a 5-month high. And so we're not really seeing any relief really in the rental market yet.
Yeah, it's a tough one, right? It's where we are. I mean, I was having a conversation recently with this person. They were looking, you know, they were trying to rent, find a place to live, and their rent has gone up. You know, what happened? They're renting. And then their landlord say, hey, we're raising rent, you know, when the lease is up in September or something. And, you know, of course, the person is very upset about it. And they're saying, hey, you know, they're just being greedy and all that stuff. But, you know, Steve, even you would recognize if you are a landlord, all of a sudden your costs have gone up because rates have gone from 0 to 5 or taxes have gone up and increase and so forth. This rise in rental rates, I think people need to appreciate that it doesn't mean that the landlords are being greedy. I'm sure some people are trying to, you know, you mark it up to market. I mean, that's what you would do, of course. But there's a lot of these big issues at play. And it's not a simple decision just to say, hey, can you, you know, reduce the rent? You know, you don't want to do that either. I don't know. You know, it's just a observation. There's no solution for this. But we are, again, it's funny. Hey, by the way, a special hello to... one of my friends, Tyler T, out in Surrey. So Tyler watches the show all the time. He said, hey, I want you guys to be a bit more positive because you're coming out with a negative view on things. Yeah. So we'll tie into that. But hey, one of the big positive things to look at is this is my view now. I don't know about you guys, but it's going to be an incredible opportunity to buy corporate debt at some time soon. So that that's the positive view on something that could happen.
Hey, you want some more positive views? Crypto bull market, baby. We're rolling.
What number? How much is it now, Steve?
Number go up. So don't ask. Number go up. I don't know. I mean, depends on how you measure it. Obviously, if you're a Canadian looking at Bitcoin, I think it's at 96,000 today. So that's an all-time high. You know, is that funny? Did you see that video I tweeted, Rich?
No, which one? Oh yeah, Go ahead.
The one where JT was making fun of Pierre Polyev for. It's like an old clip. I think it's from like a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, during the crypto bear market. Because remember, during the last bull market, Pierre Polyev, I think he went on CTV News and they were talking about inflation, you know, is at like multi-decade highs. And he was like, yeah, you know, Canadians can opt out of like inflation by like buying Bitcoin. Like, and so again, maybe not the wisest of comments, of course, but I think shortly thereafter that he said that, it was like 3-4 months later, like Bitcoin of course like got chopped in half. And so JT went out on stage and was like, this guy's got no solutions. You know, he's telling people to invest in Bitcoin and just lost half its value. And so that video is now recirculating on the internet, of course, because Bitcoin is well past its all-time highs.
That's what they say. There's nowhere to hide on the internet. Is that what they call it, Rich?
Yeah. Good sentiment tops though. When your prime minister is chirping Bitcoin, that was kind of the bottom. Could have been buying.
So when do people sell then?
Never.
Never.
Steve, you're going to be, oh my God, the trolls are going to come out. You.
Oh man, we're going to have so many comments in the spam ones.
Guys, let's be straight. It was a mistake for Pierre Polyev to mention it. And I thought it then, and I think it now. And just like it was a mistake for Justin Trudeau to take the bait. Like, politicians should not be making financial recommendations. What the hell is going on here? Like, just focus on policy and leave the finance to three babbling turds like us and, you know, professionals.
Also, if you're in the YouTube comments, do not day trade crypto with Mrs. Smith. Yeah. Don't give her your WhatsApp number and and opt in. There's a lot of those comments. I don't have the time and the bandwidth to go in and delete them. So if you're trying to trade with Mrs. Smith, please do not do that. Back to the show.
Back to the show.
Boomer, what else are you on your radar?
Well, I mean, we have the whole deficit discussion that's coming up, which I think it does tie into the carbon tax, you know, for April 1. Maybe think about it from that perspective. But I just want to introduce a conversation about, you know, what does Canada have to do to avoid an economic recession or a hard landing or collapse, if you want to use that word, you know, for
clickbait. So native.
I know, positive. But the opportunity here to be positive is then, you know, most people, you know, sort of in line with the crypto conversation just then, you know, in general, you want to buy low and sell high. And people always do the opposite, right? That's just what happens.
I see it in housing every day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've seen a lot of different markets as well, right? Like even with, maybe we should run through the U.S. inflation data first though, Rich.
Sure.
That's another great example of, you know, buying low and selling high, because, you know, 3 months ago, people were calling for the Fed to cut by almost 150 basis points. And now they're hoping that the Fed, you know, cuts by 50 basis points before the election. You know what they say about hope as an investment strategy, Steve?
It's a good one.
Works every time.
All the time. 100%.
Number go up.
Magic eight ball says. But what were the Rich, why don't you share with everyone the American PPI data, what it is, yeah, sure, first, and why it's important for the Fed?
Sure. So CPI is a consumer price index. It's
PPI
released...
Papa India PPI.
Oh, my bad. Oh, but we also had the CPI. Okay. Well, anyway, so PPI is producer price index. So similar to the consumer price index, it's a basket of goods for producers instead of consumers. Seems reasonable. And it is more related to industry and businesses, both services, but mostly, I would say it's mostly an industrial piece. You've got food, intermediate stuff, manufacturing, all the different tiers and what have you. And PPI, you know, people look at the year-on-year demand, but what people really seem to focus on, the market seems to focus, is the month-on-month change, and always it's all about relative to expectations. So the dislocations you get in markets, regardless of virtually any subject and any asset, is always what people expect or what the markets expect, and whether or not you are above or below that, and by how much. And then, so the PPI X food and energy came in higher than expected, 0.3 versus 0.2, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is, came hotter than expected, especially after this week's CPI, which also came a bit hotter than expected. Year on year, we've now started to reaccelerate. So we were at 0.9 and now we're at 1.6. So if you think of the chart, maybe we'll share it, starting to reaccelerate. And then X food and energy is still 2%. Why that's important is because, you know, 6 months ago, we were getting into the soft landing, inflation was cooling, growth was okay, and you got a lot of the cuts getting priced out of the sort of futures market and the bond market. And so we're starting to see slowly but surely is that some of us on this show, and actually some of my colleagues, we've sort of triangulated this, is that we think that inflation is going to surprise the upside, which is going to put pressure on the Fed, but this time to not cut. Is that right, Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another conversation you're starting to see now related to this inflation expectation is that actually oil supplies are going to start to surprise on the downside. And what that means is that supplies are going to be growing less, or inventories are growing less than what was needed. So we could fall into or experience the classic stagflation experience, which is mean you have, you know, very low economic growth, but inflation continues to stay stubbornly high. So on a, you know, an after inflation perspective, on a real rate perspective, you know, we continue to fall behind, which means productivity is going to start declining as well. But it creates a whole host of problems where we're going. So for today, you know, I think, you know, most people know we record on Thursdays, of course, and you're listening to this on Friday. But today, what's happening with the bond market, guys? Steve, the long end of the curve, what's happening? What's the word?
You're falling better than I am.
It's getting mullered. It's getting mullered, guys. It's getting absolutely.
Oh, wow, 10 basis points. That's a lot. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot.
With the 10-year of the U.S. is now back to almost 4.30 right now, so 4.30. And I think it got just about under 4 there a couple of weeks ago. But
Canada 5-year bond, which I follow for mortgage rates, is up 9 basis points today. Big move.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Keith, can I ask you a question? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, shoot.
Why do you think the market's sort of shrugging off these higher rates? Because, you know, in the 6 months ago, when the rates went up, market kind of went down. And then when rates went down, market went up. And there was like a really great chart circulating the internet of this like really nice relationship that we seem to see. And that broke, I think, a couple of months ago, a week ago. I don't know. But why do you think the market's just shrugging that off now?
You mean equities?
Yeah, excuse me. Sorry, equities. Yes.
Yeah. So I think what's happening here right now is that, you know, all of a sudden you're going to get like a sort of a steady monetary policy environment, a sort of what you deemed as. That's great for the tech market, you know, tech stocks. And we have, I don't want to use the words, but I think people know what it is, the Magnificent Seven, you know, you have that.
It's 6 now, apparently.
Is it 6? Yeah, Tesla's dropped out.
Yeah.
Yeah, one by one, you know, they'll fall off. What was the name of the old war movie back in the 50s? Was it Magnificent Seven?
No, it was the Seven Samurai.
No. I think Lee Marvin was in this movie.
Oh, I don't know who Lee Marvin is.
1950s?
Yeah. Uncle Johnny Chater.
Was it black and white? Was it black and white?
That was a big hit back in his day.
I think it was like, you know, at the school theater, you know, they jump out from behind the screens. Anyway, but the point is, you know, it's always funny when the market's moving in a different direction, people, hey, why is it moving that way? And people try to figure out, oh, it's for this reason or that reason. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, everyone, like people are sort of using an educated guess on why it's happening. But right now, you know, we have a lot of euphoria with the Magnificent Six, I guess now. And money just, when money is buying, you know, people are buying now. It's, you know, earlier it was buy low and sell high, but people do the opposite all the time. So you get that, you know, that's momentum in the market. And, but it's, you know, it's really the bond market though, that you really have to continue to look for and continue to watch credit spreads and so forth. But in this environment where, hey, the economy is going to do well and the inflation is going to go lower, you know, right now the 10-year should be down to 3%, 3.5%. And the fact that it's going in the opposite direction, you know, that tells me that, okay, now we're starting to, you know, sort of price, you know, where it should be going. And of course, you know, in the currency world, you know, the dollar is just ripping higher today. The U.S. dollar is. You get the ECB coming out with news as well. You know, they're saying, hey, maybe we won't be the first one to cut. You know, they're all trying to keep up with the dollar. Because again, if the Fed doesn't cut, or even if they raise rates, for example, because that would, you know, be the, you know, the shock heard around the world. The other central banks have to stay in line with the Fed. Because if not, as you point out, Rich, you know, your currency is going to come off hard. And then that's going to, you know, give you inflation domestically and so forth. But it just seems like the complacency, it's pretty good right now. So, you know, everyone enjoy it while they can, but make sure you have protection available. Because, you know, markets can keep you honest pretty quickly.
On that side, though, are we not seeing, like, you know, in a lot of the data points, you're seeing an easing of financial conditions, an uptick in liquidity as well?
Yes.
And ultimately, you know, liquidity drives markets. I mean, are you, like, how much do we incorporate all that?
So, like, you know, I think people that know us, you know, I'm not a big believer in fundamentals, you know, growth and valuation and that stuff. If liquidity is flowing into any market, it's going to push it higher. I mean, that's exactly what's going to happen. So I don't have a great answer for you. All you know that right now, hey, the complacency is quite high. The perception of risk, whether it's financial risk, market risk, economic risk, you know, it's quite low. And it's moved dramatically over the last couple of months. And, you know, a lot of people are now starting to compare, you know, this current movement in the, you know, the tech world or AI world or Magnificent 7-1 world. But they are going back and comparing it, you know, to the 1999-2000 tech bubble. So you guys remember that as well, right? So that was, no.
I do.
There's a lot of similarities, and people say, oh, no, it's not the same. For everyone to know, that was when the internet was created.
Come on.
And it's true, Rich. And if you think that, you know, AI is going to change the world and then, you know, all these of course. But back then it was, wow, the internet is going to change the world. And you get this euphoria, you know, going for so long until it stops and it ends and something else, you know, take it out. So I asked earlier, you know, what would cause you to sell, you know, crypto? And again, I'm not advising that you should buy or sell it. You know, it's for you to decide that yourself. But I always remember that fundamentals don't really matter with markets. It's just that as soon as people decide, hey, I'm getting out, the market will come off, and then the opposite will happen. So, like, I love extreme moves in markets because we're not in a linear world. It is cyclical. And you think we're in a linear world and you're a commie and, you know, you don't want to be a commie. That's not popular anymore. But maybe it is, Rich. You hang around McGill, right? University campuses are...
Yeah, well, that hasn't changed either in 30 or 40 years. But so I think Keith is articulating one of the fault lines that he and I have just philosophically about markets. I'm much more into fundamentals. I believe liquidity has a place. But for me, I would say that we're starting to see, and I think this is what Steve was touching on, is like we've actually seen a reacceleration in growth. And I would submit there's actually a bunch of indicators that support that view, which is, you know, exports from Korea. So we've talked about this before, Korean export. Korea basically makes everything, phones, ships, shoes, fridges, cars, etc. And their exports are usually a leading indicator on economic activity, but also of earnings growth.
Is that North or South Korea? Yeah. Which one?
I'll let the viewers decide which one it is. And also in the US, in Bloomberg, you can find out things called like consensus economic forecasts, which you know, are always fraught with issues, but what we like to see is directions and inflection points. And in the US, you know, it's decoupled from the rest of, you know, the G7 and the rest of the developed world. We've also seen sort of, you know, I always talk about PMIs and ISMs and those kinds of diffusion index. We're starting to see a bottoming in those. And that's the reason I'm bringing up sort of these like cyclical indicators that show that you're actually getting sort of an improving growth picture, as well as what Steve said, which is easier financial conditions, low credit spreads, etc., is because with the PPI coming in hotter and the CPI coming in hotter and some like pretty concrete cyclical improvement in growth expectations, that's what puts the Fed in a real bind. That is to say, I think that they, you know, we've sort of thrown this out that they're not going to be able to cut as much. Who knows? And why this matters for Canadians is because ultimately, I think that the Bank of Canada, Keith, I'd like to hear your views on this. Ultimately, I think the Bank of Canada is tied to what sort of the Fed's doing. And so this is why it's all sort of related and why you have to pay attention to these different markets.
And you have
Keith, I'm kind of curious your thoughts. I just wanted to quickly chime in there. Yeah. So one of the good follows on Twitter is a guy called Cross Border Capital, Michael Howe. So he measures basically, he has his own way of measuring liquidity. So he's got liquidity. Inching up to record highs right now. So basically, yeah, just an easing of financial conditions. And then, Rich, you know, we've got the Atlanta Fed's gauge of sticky inflation. That's risen to about 5% on a three-month annualized basis. So inflation is moving in the wrong direction for the Fed, which is interesting when you consider the fact that the market's base case is still that the Fed is going to cut rates by about 100 basis points by January of 2025.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about the CPI, but Keith's wanted to jump in there, so let him do that.
Yeah, so again, this is our process. We look at this and say, what's creating this economic growth? And it sort of comes back to like, you know, per capita perspective and things like that. So what's creating this growth right now? And again, this is our view. It doesn't mean it's wrong or right. I know we're right, but you know, for this conversation, maybe we could be wrong every now and then. But, you know, so our concern is that what is supporting, you know, a lot of these different data points, a lot of the, you know, the indices that you pointed out, Rich, is that it's government spending. So it's fiscal spending. I think you're seeing what the White House is proposing for the new budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Is it 1.6 trillion or 1.7? Something like that.
It's huge. I don't know.
It's an insane number. And up here, if you know, for the Canadians, it's the same thing. You know,
well, not as big. It's not as big, but it's still big.
It's still, you know, from a Canadian perspective, what we've done historically, you know, they're hoping it's going to keep it at $40 billion, I think, for the next 5 years. Like it's kind of funny. Like they're measuring fiscal success by not growing the deficit any more than at $40 billion a year. But $40 billion a year is still an extra $40 billion in debt. And then you add your financing costs on top of it. And that's where my concern comes in, is that the growth and what's the positive data points we're seeing from an economic perspective, and we'll keep it here for Canada right now, it's coming from the fiscal spending side, from government spending, and the population growth. So, I mean, the central banks are dying to, you know, to reel this in, because that's how they slow down recession, of course. And now we're at the point where, hey, inflation is probably not slowing anymore. It might be accelerating. Who knows? And then, you know, of course, you have the election cycle that's taking place for the Americans as well as for Canada, most likely next year. So again, we're getting into this place where it's simply a continuation of governments as well as households as well, and because they're being forced to, but they're just gorging on debt. And you circle back to, hey, is that productive? Again, it's our view, it is not. So I think that's why, you know, we continue to be on this slippery slope here. And
but like
you gotta be mindful of it.
So how do we play this out? This is like if you're the Bank of Canada, Rich, last thing you want to see, you know, inflation might be easing here in Canada. Obviously, highly levered households that are suffocating under debt servicing payments.
So I would say there's less of an inflationary impulse, let's say, in Canada, but you look over to your counterparts in the US and it's like, hey, like the data is still coming pretty hot. You know, US CPI, US PPI this week, you know, the Atlanta Fed's 3 month gauge there. And so you're looking at all this and going, man, like the Fed doesn't really have a whole lot of excuse here to cut rates. I think the BOC can maybe make a different argument, but how can you start aggressively cutting rates in Canada if the Fed isn't? You know, this looks like an absolute nightmare potentially for Canadian homeowners who, as of right now, we've talked about, right? 50% of the float hasn't seen a mortgage payment increase. They still got to renew. And so they could be renewing, you know, in the next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 15 months from now, at rates that are still a lot higher than people need them to be.
So Rich, what is your central bank crush, Carolyn Rogers, going to do then? What is she feeling?
Yeah. You chat with her lately?
No, sadly, she doesn't call me back. I've left her messages.
We should get her on the show.
I'd love to have a central banker on the show. Call to any and all central bankers. Welcome on the Looney Hour anytime. We will stop everything and have you on. Oh, speaking of central bankers that we could have on the show, did you hear that Janet Yellen admitted that she shouldn't have said that inflation was transitory?
I saw that,
like,
yeah.
That is, I'm just wanting to take a bow. I have to take a victory. Like, man, do we fight that battle strong? Eh,
she
Keith?
Also
that
said there was never
going
to be a financial crisis in our lifetimes again. So
I mean, that I'm less interested in because whatever.
But let's go back, Joe, to the Bank of Canada decision that Rich What are you doing, Rich? Like, what would you do besides quit? You can't quit your job. This is your job, right?
If I was a Central Bank of Canada, I would keep interest rates here until population growth came back to some kind of normal number. Because
so I'm Ottawa, and I'm telling you, it ain't happening. We're going to increase population, and we're going to spend.
Well, then I would submit to them something that I just looked up on Wikipedia, which is something called the neutral rate of interest or natural rate of interest. I always screw this up, and I just screwed it up again.
I think it's the neutral rate.
Sorry. So basically what you're saying is each economy will have a interest rate that effectively sort of maximizes out. It's a theoretical construct, of course, and the whole theory is, as we should inform the kids at McGill, is usually never works, but it's important kind of model to think about, which is depending on how fast your economy is growing, there's a rate at which you should more or less keep inflation constant. The interest rate will keep inflation constant with that output.
It's basically, let me summarize this.
I screwed this up.
it's the level of interest rate that is neither stimulating the economy nor dragging the economy down.
Thank you.
So what is that interest rate?
So my
look
point
at that, Steve, yeah, look at that. Steve putting Rich in the box.
Just dunked on me. Just dunked on me.
Nerd.
So my point, okay. So to save some grace here, my point is if you have population growth, especially of prime age workers. So population growth right now is like 3.2% year on year. And you have, let's say, some productivity growth. Let's say it's 1%. That means your real GDP growth should be 4% or whatever. So you can't, so that means like you have some kind of lower bound as to where your interest rate, your monetary policy rate will be before you start to increase inflation again. And so remember two things. One is that inflation is still above target. And two, population growth is really high. So that's the problem. You have this, the tide is coming in. Or let's say another different. One person in the canoe is paddling one way and the other person in the canoe is paddling the other way. And until those two get in the same direction, which is to lower deficits and to lower population growth, the Bank of Canada will have to, if they have any independence, a shred of independence left in Ottawa, they will keep interest rates.
So I'm Ottawa and I'm responding to whatever you just barfed out there. you're babbling turds.
Yeah, that's right.
I would respond, I say neutral rates, mutual rate. I don't care. We're going to continue to go down this path. So like, I want to go. So I made a few notes.
Okay. You got some, I was going to ask you, I wanted to ask you guys a hypothetical here. Cause I know for sure there's listeners that are listening to this. You know, I think Canada has almost 30% of the mortgage float is a variable rate mortgage. So I want to play a hypothetical scenario, Rich, with your central bank now that you're running the BOC. What would you do in this scenario? So today your variable rate mortgage, I'm going to call it 6%. Let's just keep the numbers simple. 6%. Let's say you can get a variable rate, or sorry, a fixed rate mortgage, a 3-year fixed today at 4.75. Now, again, the numbers aren't perfect, but the math is basically there's about 120 basis points spread between those two. So what do you do? Do you hope that the BOC cuts? Because that's basically 6 cuts. Do you think the BOC is going to get 6 cuts or over the next couple of years? Or do you take it today and say, you know what, I've got my variable rate mortgage, I'm going to convert this thing to a 3-year fixed and lock in at whatever, 4.8, let's call it. What do you do?
I mean, I guess if 100, yeah, I guess I would call the bluff. So I would lock in the 3-year because I don't think 150 basis points is coming. Keith?
Keith, I'm curious your thoughts. And this is not financial advice, of course, but it's an interesting like thought process. I think, yeah. I know this conversation is happening in the marketplace, and I just was kind of curious to throw it your guys' way, right? Like, there's a lot of smart arguments being made on both sides for why the BOC should cut and the rate is too high. You know, like Rich, I mean, what would you use? You would use the real rate of inflation today, which is, what do you want to use? Core inflation at, let's call it 3.5. The BOC is at 5. So, you know, real rates are 1.5%.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which is, I would say, is a break on the economy.
It is, but we've been running.
How long can you hold this break?
At one point, we had 10 years of negative real interest rates. There's no free lunch. This is what people like in Canada just don't get. Like, this idea that you can have a perpetual free money forever and never have any negative consequences whatsoever is not reality. That is
exactly. So you're taking the 3-year, 125 basis points lower.
I'm not trying to dance around this, but first of all, what Rich said is 1% correct, and people won't like to hear this, but you need to hear it. We had over a decade where risk was not allowed to be expressed in financial markets. And that was achieved with central banks being at zero, near zero, and negative, and using QE for, you know, to keep the yield curve low and flattish. If I was rich at the Bank of Canada, you know, I wouldn't go into this big theoretical conversation about neutral rates and everything. I, you know, and you can't go back in hindsight, well, I would have done this or that. As of right now today, I would raise rates 50 basis points tomorrow morning, even 75 or 100, crush the economy. And yeah, people don't like this because they know they're going to lose their jobs, going to lose their houses and mortgages, business. But if you believe in an economic cycle and the way an economic cycle works, you know, it rewards, you know, risk, you know, prudent risk, and it punishes people who have taken on risk that they shouldn't have. And it doesn't mean, hey, you know, you should have done that or you should have done this. It has to flush out of the system, you know, excessive risk. And that's the market we're in. So when I commented earlier, you know, to my friend Tyler that, hey, the positive thing here is that I think we're in a great buying opportunity in corporate debt at some point, which of course implies there's some pretty big losses coming up in the bond market. To go into this conversation about where you think rates are going to be and everything, it comes down to your personal choice. Would you prefer to have your payment locked in for 7 years? Can you get 7 now, Steve? Or
yeah,
10 years?
Yeah, you can. You get 5, you get 7. You technically get 10, but like, Ken, nobody ever takes the 7 or the 10.
Yeah, because we've had, you know, 12, 15 years, the rates always going lower. You know, why would you be a sucker and do that, right? Unless rates have hit zero and then they ricocheted higher. And I just think that if the Bank of Canada, if they are cutting rates aggressively over the next 6 months or whatever the time frame is going to be, it means, because Canada is in this economic disaster and they're trying to re-stimulate again. And if that's happening, you may not even have a job, right? Like, that's the challenge people are going to have here. And we have this enormous you know, Rich and I, you know, in a very funny, stupid way, carried out the conversation between the monetary policy side and in the fiscal side, you know, what should be done. But again, we've been backed, and not just Canada, the same as, you know, other countries around the world. We've been backed in this extremely awkward situation that something has to budge. And the only way to keep it going is to have increasingly more and more debt, and you can't have a recession. And again, you know, I'm sounding like a broken record, but we're in a cycle here. Cycles and bubbles break, and it is a debt market, a bond market bubble that we're in. And again, expecting rates to come down hard, I wouldn't go playing a variable rate game. I would try to lock in something so I know what my payment is going to be, and then I don't have to worry about it. But that's just my own personal.
No, I think that's
stance.
I mean,
I'm
think,
conservative, right? I'm conservative. That's the way I look at
it. Well, I do think that mortgage advice in general is always a personal finance decision, right? How much cash do you have kicking around for a rainy day? How much do you want to sleep at night knowing you got the peace of mind? It's, you know, but yeah, like I said, I think it's just interesting given where the expectations are in the market for rate cuts from the BOC. I think they're still calling for, what, 75 basis points of cuts by the end of this year. Again, maybe it's zero. Maybe it's, you know, I've got our good friend, maybe we'll have him back on the show. Ben Rabideau, you know, he's calling for, I think we just read his latest piece, you know, he thinks 150 basis points of cuts this year because Canada is up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. So we'll see. I mean, I think there's some very smart arguments to be made on both sides, but I mean, for me anyways, personally, I just keep looking at the US and saying, man, like, yeah, I just don't see how you can get 150 basis points of cuts or 75 even from the BOC if the Fed doesn't move at all.
Can I just jump in? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Steve. Go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, I'll just throw these points out here and then we can banter them around as well. So I think we are running for a bit of a time crunch for Rich.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, by the way, guys, I did fall
so
off.
So much fun.
Yeah, I fell off the small bar stool last time. And that's why week's episode, I'm cut short.
Got just early on us.
Yeah, it just went. Yeah, it was happy hour.
Thankfully, he's sober today.
That's right.
Yeah, I was really funny last week. Wasn't that great? But the there are some points here. This is what I have on my notes here. Like, what Canada needs to do to avoid a hard economic landing, which is, you know, means a hard recession or even, you know, if you want to use the collapse word. But without going into details each one, first of all, we have to maintain the current population growth. So do a check mark or an X if that's going to happen. We need
to maintain 3%?
We need to maintain this growth. Just this is to, again, this is what needs to happen to avoid a hard landing. Okay. I'm not saying they should or shouldn't. If they stop the population growth, it's game over. It's done. They will be cutting rates dramatically. We need to increase the fiscal deficit at Ottawa and for provinces. So if we're now at a $40 billion deficit, this is going to creep up to 45 or 50. Again, government has to continue borrowing more and more to produce that same dollar of output. They cannot increase taxes. Because if they do increase taxes, it'll help on the fiscal side, which brings the deficit down. But it also takes away discretionary money from households. But they can't do that. Inflation has to slow. If inflation continues to stay sticky and goes higher, again, there's less money available, you know, for spending. And then the last one, we need the rest of the world to also avoid the recession. So everyone in the world has to, you know, maintain their current economy growing by continue to increase their deficit with borrowing, don't raise taxes, and then, you know, you use that hope strategy.
The boomer checklist. There's one
That's
more.
The boomer. Yeah. What is it, Rich?
A massive increase in productivity growth.
But if we have that scenario just laid out, I mean, productivity continues to decline, right?
Yeah. Oh, I know. I'm just saying if we had a massive, like if aliens landed on the moon or whatever, on the moon, if aliens landed on Earth and provided, I don't know, some kind of technology that increased productivity significantly. Okay. That's a bad example. My point is if increase in productivity went from 0 to +3, that would deal with a lot of these problems.
Can you imagine the disappointment for the aliens? You know, they travel like millions of light years and they land on the moon and they find out that someone was already there.
Yeah.
The AI boom is going to save us, baby.
Yeah.
Robots.
Maybe that's what it
work.
Is. Yeah. It was like the internet when the internet was created. That helped out.
There's did you see there's they got some AI now that's building a subdivision of homes in Texas.
Interesting.
They got some AI. The AI basically, I was reading it the other day on Bloomberg. So they got the AI that basically created the blueprints for the house, basically like essentially kind of replaced like the architect. And then they have some robots with AI involved that are 3D printing the houses. And so
it's not Google. It's not Gemini AI, is it? Because Gemini had a few hiccups.
But yeah, anyways, it's interesting. So they're building 100 houses in a subdivision in Texas, and they're doing it for, I can't remember which it was, but it's one of the largest publicly traded home builders in the US. So I guess they've partnered up basically, and they're building these 100 houses using basically AI and robots, which is kind of crazy. I mean, obviously I still think it's a long, long way away, and there's a lot of complications. You think about all these stupid building codes and...
But I don't get it. Are they cutting down the trees and making the lumber?
No, so what they're doing, these houses are basically, if you ever watch those videos of like a 3D printed house, like it's all, they use concrete. So they don't build like, you know, they're not using framing, like cutting, chopping wood and building a house that way. They basically just like pour concrete and just kind of keeps going around in like a circle. It's crazy. I don't know. Yeah, it's really hard cool. to explain. You have to see the
no,
video.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It gets squidged out of the thing. It's like an arm yeah. that sticks from the top, and it squidges out the concrete, and it just traces what Steve, I guess, is describing is an AI-generated floor plan.
It's pretty cool. I mean, again, the technology is still like very early, and this is by no means a panacea, but it's cool. Like I could see it in 10 years from now being like, hey, like this is how we build a lot of housing now, at least in some communities. The problem is like, you've got all these like building codes, you have to do it, and you have to get 300 city inspectors to check off on the work at each stage. So I think ultimately it's going to be politics and compliance that's going to get in the way of some of this technology being adopted in a much more rapid fashion.
Surely, shouldn't we get the AI to do the coded compliant? I mean, humans should build and get the AI to just double check and cross check. And at least they would do it fast. They don't have to have specific working hours. They can arrive at any time to check the building code at any time in the morning. You know what I mean? That's what we should be. We should get some AI regulators. That would be great, right, Keith? I'm sure that'll never have any problems with it.
Soon we don't have to work.
Did you say Shirley?
Hey, did you see that? It was who is that? Wasn't it Klaus Schwab? Is that your buddy, Keith?
Yeah, he's Keith's buddy,
the left guy, the World Economic Forum guy that says you won't even have
the commie. The commie. I'm into the commies.
He's like, you won't have to vote anymore. The AI will do it for you.
Oh, I did watch that. That was.
And I was like,
well, guys, let's not get misled with this whole voting stuff. Because remember, after all, if they let you vote, it just means it doesn't matter.
Oh, shame on you. I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it. We'll end it on a conspiracy theory.
Oh, good. Nihilistic and, note.
Yeah, as always, guys, we appreciate the support. Any commentary, feedback, we always welcome your emails. We do get quite a bit of listener feedback. And so love us or hate us, we'd love to hear your commentary from a couple babbling turds. And as always, we'll see you next week.